life to think things over. What good's a few more minutes gonna do you now? Hello and welcome to episode 182 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other isolated lunatics as masterpieces. I am Nick, the psychic child of the podcast, and I'm joined as ever by Roger.
Grrr. Glug, 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 glug.
No sign of an axe, at least. We are discussing another Stanley Kubrick film.
I said earlier, the axe is my wife, she just lets me borrow it.
That's not entirely reassuring. I forgot my...
Another Stanley Kubrick film.
Another Stanley Kubrick film. Another Stephen King film. This is The Shining, 1980. The psychological horror slash ghost story slash slasher film, I guess. But being Kubrick, it's kind of not quite any of those and all of those together. Well, I suggested it partly because I remember it being very visually striking. I remember having seen it before. I remember, like much of Kubrick's work, and I know it's a cliche with Kubrick, but I get it, in that it happens to me as well. I often find it very kind of clinical and sanitized, and just feels like he's less interested in the human story than the aesthetics to me.
Yeah, though I think he is often trying and sometimes succeeding in being visceral here.
That was my memory of it.
That's why it's an interesting edge of his capacity, I think, in this regard.
Well, we'll talk it through and see how we felt. My memory of it was that it was very slow, quite scary in places, but quite cold and detached from the humanity. I'm not sure that's quite how I feel having watched it again, but we'll talk it through. So this is based on Stephen King, one of the early Kings, 1977. I think he'd done a couple of novels before, probably, I think Carrie might have been his first one, maybe Salem's Lot, maybe. But The Shining was one of his big breakthrough blockbusters. He was already pretty famous by this point. And so Kubrick, there's various different accounts of how Kubrick picked it, and King was always saying how Kubrick was so excited to do it, and Kubrick was a bit less vocal about it. They started off very happily collaborating. Stephen King hated this film, absolutely hated it. And we can talk why, I guess, discuss why.
Well, I will just say, as I always say when it comes to Stephen King's opinions or the film of his books, maximum overdrive.
You are not allowed to have an opinion, Stephen King.
Which, to be fair, he made largely while off his head on cocaine, but even so...
I mean, he wrote Misery while he was basically off his head on cocaine, so he was capable of some good work. So this is the story of Jack Torrance, Danny Torrance, his son, and his mum, his wife, oh my god, Shelley Duvall, but I've forgotten the name of her character. Wendy Torrance. So a family that Jack is I think he's just a writer in the film. I can't quite remember. Because I know the book a bit as well, I may accidentally get mixed up between which one's which, but I think in the film he's just a writer, whereas in the book he's a teacher who has been sacked for abusing a child.
Yeah, I don't think it really says what else he may do, and I think that is suggestive in itself. I'll come back to that. There are some differences in cuts here. I saw what turned out to be the European cut, where there is a scene with Wendy talking to a doctor.
Yes, that's
fairly early in the film, which is not in the European cut.
Oh, interesting. Okay,
so it leaves that all ambiguous until later on when it's mentioned briefly.
Okay, so the scene in question is where it is explained that Jack has a drinking problem, but he has been sober ever since he got so drunk that he threw his kid on the floor and threw Danny on the floor and dislocated his shoulder.
Hmm.
So we're aware there is some propensity to alcoholism and Drunken Violence with their
project. And if we haven't seen that, then it's clearly kind of tense, but we don't know why.
Yeah, so even the opening scene when they're driving, so we open with the film where he's being interviewed at the Overlook Hotel, which is this very isolated skiing kind of resort. Well, it's not really a skiing resort. A hotel up in the Rockies in Denver.
Yeah, it's a summer mountain sports hotel, basically. Yes.
And it closes for the winter because it's such a big hotel that it's too expensive to keep open because they can't keep the road open because it's like a 20-mile drive to get there through, and there's nothing else to get there except the hotel.
Yeah, it's strongly suggested that you just can't, you know, you can't hope to get a car through this.
Yes, yeah.
For four months.
Not worth it. So it's like 8 months of the year it's closed, and so Jack has been hired as the caretaker, basically to stop it exploding, the boiler blowing up, spoilers for the book, not the film.
Yeah, essentially do the basic maintenance, fix any burst pipes before they flood the entire place, that kind of thing.
Yes, basically just be on hand to stop. But otherwise, you're completely isolated in the winter for 8 months. And it's not quite clear why they think this is a great... So Jack, I think, is hoping to finish his magnum opus to work on his novel. And whether the idea is to get a bit, as you say, it's quite clear in the film, there's tension, because even on the drive up, Jack is showing some peculiar signs of, I don't know, psychopathy, I guess, in that he's a little detached.
Oh, yeah, kind of just being an asshole. There is a particular line.
There's a fine line between them sometimes.
The subject of cannibalism comes up. Wendy says, yeah, let's not talk about that in front of Danny, the kid, basically because it suggested that something like that might have happened. Something bad happened to a previous caretaker. He killed his own wife and children.
Yes.
And himself. But anyway... And then Danny says, that's okay, I know about cannibalism, I saw it on the television. And Jack at this point says, oh, it's okay, he saw it on the television, in a very, I am having a dig at you for being a bad mother and letting him see this stuff, in a way that you cannot reply to without starting an actual argument.
Yes, and because she's clearly been in this situation before, she doesn't kind of reply to it. Yeah, so... And
that's well before he's potentially come under any supernatural influence. Now, this is the thing I would like to come back to, because there is meant to be an ambiguity, I think, most of the way through this. Is this actually something supernatural trying to turn Jack to the bad, or is it just his own essential assholeness?
There's a point in the film where it kind of pushes that beyond psychology.
I think worth mentioning because it's deliberately kept ambiguous until that point.
And this is a couple of points of divergence. So first of all, the cinematography here is, you know, incredible. You know, the views of them driving across this ice, which I think were views that were later pinched for Blade Runner later on, for the happy ending Blade Runner version. But anyway, the views of them traveling along this ice lake.
This is on the days when an aerial shot like that needed an actual plane or a helicopter, not just a drone.
Yes, exactly. all throughout this, the visuals, I mean, Kubrick is clearly experimenting or pushing towards symbolism in a way that I don't always like symbolism, because there's often, when you're being ambiguous, I often find it is because you want people to think you're cleverer than you are, because people will fill in the gaps with things that they think you thought about, but often you didn't. I do credit Kubrick with actually having very specific meanings in mind for all the visuals we get here, and here we're just seeing the isolation. And for all I said, you know, it's very sort of cold and clinical, I do think he is quite quick to establish the dynamics of the family, even if there is a slightly stilted nature. There isn't a stilted nature to Jack Nicholson. I mean, Jack Nicholson here, frankly, is doing his Jack Nicholson shtick.
That was a thing that it suddenly occurs to me. Has he actually ever been in a sympathetic role? I haven't seen that many films. I mean, in Chinatown, a bit. That's fair enough.
I think
definitely not for me in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, though I think he's meant to be. Later on, he will be the Joker in Batman and the devil figure in The Witches of Eastwick, and neither of those are sympathetic.
The one that springs to mind is As Good As It Gets, which is where he's an irascible asshole, but it does it from a sympathetic viewpoint.
Fair enough, I haven't seen that one.
But he's still basically doing his shtick.
The impression I get is that at least at the start, I'm meant to have some sympathy with the guy. I mean, default protagonist sympathy anyway. But, you know, I haven't seen the bit about the alcoholism because that was the cut I saw, but clearly he has had some problems and he's trying to get it right.
Well, I said there are two points of diversion from King around about now. The first is what you were talking about, that Kubrick really tones down the supernatural. It is much more overt in King's book, to the point where it's not possible, you know, that it would be ambiguous. It clearly is. And we'll talk about other points of that later. But King didn't like that. The other thing is that in the book, well, it's actually semi-autobiographical, which might be why King particularly objected to this film, because a similar thing happened to Stephen King, that he got drunk and his kids had, I think his daughter at that point, but one of his children had basically rearranged the manuscript that he'd been working on at the time and threw it all over the floor. And he was so angry that he threw his child to the floor and hurt them. Mm. And this book sort of stemmed out of that. And because it's sort of semi-biographical, autobiographical, Jack Torrance is much more sympathetic. And the whole point of the film is sort of the whole point of the book, maybe not the whole point, but a big theme of the book is watching Jack turn from this sympathetic character into the murderous lunatic he becomes. Yeah. Spoiler. But in the film, it's pretty clear Jack's already a bit of an asshole right from the start.
That's the thing, yeah. We first see him having the interview. There's a weird bit of dubbing here. The guy who's interviewing him has to deliver the line something like, there's a tremendous sense of isolation.
Yes.
And at least in the version I saw, the word isolation is clearly from a completely different take with completely different intonation. Yeah. I notice these things. I sometimes patch together the recordings we make and other podcasts, and sometimes it just doesn't work. There's obviously a break. And that's what's happening here. And that seems weird. It seems odd that they couldn't get, you know, one good read of that line.
Well, Kubrick famously does. It's surprising that he would let something like that go as well, but maybe he's got more of an eye, a visual eye, than audible. I don't remember it. Maybe it wasn't in the cut I saw, but also you've got more of an ear for it than me. But I don't know if Kubrick would just let that. I mean, he's one of those directors that is, we discussed perfectionist directors when we talked about them. I've already forgotten the name of it. Ishtar?
Yeah.
But Kubrick is one of those that famously just makes the actors work and work and work and work until they're very tired. Which some actors respond differently to others, I guess.
Little anecdote with the filming of Aliens. James Cameron expected to do that, but he was working in England where they actually have union rules for the crew.
I was very frustrated with it, particularly on The Abyss as well. I think they all got t-shirts saying, life's a myth, and then you dive or something like that to piss him off. Anyway.
But anyway, yeah. The other thing is that they are clearly, even up front, putting an awful lot on Danny.
Yes.
And I'm not generally in favour of child actors, though we'll at least one more in a future episode who I thought was pretty good. But yeah, they are leaning on him. He has to carry a lot of being the kid with a psychic gift. Who's gradually...
And he's very young. I forget that. So this is... The actor is Danny Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
He was like 8 during the filming, maybe? He's really quite young.
He was born in 72, so probably 7, because it's usually... Yeah, filming is the year before release,
yeah,
typically.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, whatever you do with the actor, I think the role is not suited... It might not be good for any child of that age. It's certainly not something he can carry. There are other child actors who could do it better, I honestly don't know. It may well be that there aren't. It is noticeable that he did almost no acting after this.
Well, I would give him a bit of... first of all, I totally agree with you. He leaves me cold. I don't know if that's Danny Lloyd, the actor, or if it's Kubrick, the director,
oh, yeah,
or a combination of the two.
Doing almost no acting might well be he hated the experience.
Yes, yeah. It's hard to know, but I agree. He's weirdly, and again, I find this a lot with Kubrick, he's weirdly, it's not just cold and passive, it's, the actors often seem to be sort of hitting the uncanny valley of either really over the top, which I think both Shelley Duvall and Jack Nicholson do, or they're just kind of flat, like Danny is here. Mm. But I agree, he's hard to empathise with because he has this imaginary friend who is basically the manifestation of his telepathy, but he does it with a croaky little voice, which sometimes works quite well to unsettle. Other times it's just stupid. I watched it through with my 10-year-old son, 11-year-old son now, and he just thought it was laughable, so it didn't make it scary at all for him. And he agreed with us, the child actor was not very good. I don't think that's entirely his fault. I think at this point, you've got to blame the sort of the directors and the people around him if you're not getting the performance.
I'm absolutely not saying this particular guy is rubbish. If he had done more film work, then I could say, well, I've seen this other performance and he's good.
Yeah.
I think he's been in one other thing and one cameo, and I haven't seen either of them, so.
But I agree with you. There's a lot of nuance we're trying to get across, and he's just not up to it, or I don't feel so. So they arrive at the Overlook just as it's sort of closing up for the winter and everything's moving out. There's no alcohol on site, I believe, but that's fine by Jack because he is a recovering alcoholic and doesn't want any alcohol around.
Mm.
And they're shown their little sort of caretakers. It's not little. It's quite a nice house. It's
room within the hotel. Rooms.
Yeah.
Suite.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of a little suite. Yeah. And then we're given a tour of the hotel, which is quite clever. You never really get a great sense of the geography of the hotel, but we're given the places that are going to feature
in. Part of the problem
in.
There is that basically all the interiors are on sets.
Yes.
And we talked about this with Alien, where they did the very unusual thing of actually building the entire interior of the ship in the correct relative places, so that, you know, you go from A to B, you have a sense of you've gone a certain distance, you always go out of this door to get over there, because that's actually the way to that room, and so on.
Yes. And do you think that works better at a sense? Because
I think that works for a sense of place. And here, A, they haven't done that, but also B, they haven't mostly got a real location to work with. They have for some of the external shots.
Yes.
So it never really feels grounded. I mean, yeah, here is a gorgeous tracking shot because Steadicam is new and Kubrick is a big fan of using the latest toy. That's fair enough.
And it's done very well here.
See also that huge lens he basically had developed to do the candlelight filming for whatever it was, and I've now forgotten. Anyway, that's the thing. It is probably technically impressive at the time, but it's rather lost on us now because everybody's used Steadicam.
Yes. I there's something very crisp and clean about his shots, which on the one hand impress me visually. On the other hand, I feel slightly distancing. But we get straight away in the hotel, we get these kind of ominous sign. I mean, before he even gets to the hotel, Danny, he has a seizure, doesn't he? Did you get that in your car? That's why the doctor visits him. He has
no.
a seizure in the evening. Okay, well, that's why the doctor visits him. But then he starts to get, I'm jumping ahead a bit because we get Scatman Crothers. I think we've had him before. He was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
He was the nurse, or the orderly. I forget which.
So at this point he has worked with Kubrick before and he's prepared to do it again.
well,
as indeed is Nicholson.
Shelley Duvall, on the other hand, did not ever want to work with Kubrick again after this. I think she was treated pretty badly. I don't know the specifics though, so I won't say too much, but I gather she was, I don't know if Kubrick pulled a Hitchcock on her, but apparently she had some difficulties during the film. Scatman Crothers is the cook in this film. He is,
head chef for that matter, yeah.
Halloran. And this is where we learn that he also, and this is where we learn about what the title of the film, The Shining, because he can also shine, as he calls it, which is basically a combination of Kubrick would hate this, but in technical terms,
what combination of powers are needed in the moment.
Well, yeah. Telepathy and a bit of precognition, effectively. In the book, again, this is another divergence from the book, Danny's mere presence in the hotel seems to activate the hotel. And I'm not sure that's really clear in the film. I think really we're just
doing the
impression.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's any suggestion of that here. And he certainly finds it a very edgy place for him to be, but I don't think there's any suggestion that he is triggering things himself.
Yes, exactly. Where, again, that's quite explicit in the book. He tells, I think Halloran tells Danny that the place shines and to be careful of room 237, which we now know he will clearly go into that room at some point. But, you know, it's Chekhov's 237 room. Mm. But I thought it was handled well. I do find Scatman Crothers quite a warm character. He's quite nice. Unfortunately, he disappears for most of the film, but he is quite warm in there. Already, again, we're still having Jack, and this was one of King's problems with the film, that Jack kind of almost scarcely changes through the film. He just gets less inhibited, but he's already kind of a dick.
Well, the way I thought of it, and if you do regard it as a supernatural temptation sequence, which I think is a reasonably valid interpretation, then essentially every time he is tested, he fails.
Yes.
And that causes me to think, yeah, a lot of stories that I like have arcs. You know, here is this guy who is clearly not much of a guy, but he pulls through when he's really tested hard.
Mm.
Is a more interesting story than this guy is not much of a guy, and every time he's tested, he fails, and eventually, yeah.
In a way, it's more Wendy's. I mean, Wendy is much stronger and more resourceful. I mean, it's a shame that we'll talk about it later.
Okay, so possibly I've read too much about abusive relationships, and I'm reading some of that into this. But I definitely get a feel of a lot of Duvall's acting style, more than the lines she's given, is this guy has exploded before for no obvious reason. I will try really hard not to give him a justification for exploding.
Yeah, she's definitely dancing on eggshells around him, I feel. I agree. She was nominated for a Razzie, I think, or something, the equivalent for like one of the worst acting performances, which was then withdrawn later. But I think that's really harsh. I think she's quite good here.
This was also the role that kicked her career into high gear, so.
Oh, well, so she did all right out of it regardless. Okay, so
I would just like to bring in a corner, specifically Roger's Snow Machines corner.
Oh, yes.
There's something just a little bit odd here. The hotel has what they call a snow cat.
Yes.
It is not a snow cat.
Okay.
It has two tracks, not four. There were two track snow cats, but they're very rare, and this clearly isn't one of them.
I mean, from my point of view, it's a motorised snow plough.
Well, no, it's not a plough. It's just a tracked thing you can get across the snow on.
Okay, yes, there's no plough yet.
But specifically, the actual snow cat, which has four separate tracks, you do drive just like a car, the way they describe it. Because basically the front tracks pivot like the front wheels of a car.
Right.
But the thing they have here, although it has a steering wheel, that steering wheel just changes the speed of the track.
So one starts to move slower than the other, which turns the thing.
Yeah, so you do have to drive it more or less like a tank.
Right, yes, yeah. And so a tank usually has levers for either side, doesn't it?
Yeah, so they put the steering wheel in it to try to make it easier, but I've found accounts of people driving them and they say, well, no, it really isn't like a car. It's a separate thing you have to learn, which makes it kind of a weird choice, but hey. It's not key to the plot at any point. I'm just surprised to see this error, because what they have is essentially a snow track, which is a different vehicle from a different country. So why do they call it a snow cat? Whatever.
Because it sounds cooler, I guess. it does feature in the plot later, but yes, not of any relevance otherwise. So everyone buggers off, and they settle into their routine as the winter deepens. Danny starts having more and more visions, and there's this, so there's, the carpet is very famous, the pattern of the carpet. And you can get t-shirts with that pattern on. But I mean, the carpet which lines the corridor on which room 237 is found. And we have Danny paddling round on his little pedal.
Tricycle,
yes. And he starts to encounter the ghosts of the hotel. And again, there's nothing explicit at this point. And at this point, again, it's very ambiguous as to... we are aware that Danny actually does have this telepathic ability because he has a conversation with Halloran about it. But that's the only explicit thing. He sees, and again, these are the sort of striking visual images that I do think work for me. You know, the lift opening and the blood spilling out. I mean, it's not a subtle metaphor, but it's quite striking visually. Did you find, and the two girls?
That's the thing that has been reused to death. You know, the creepy young girls.
Yes, I think that was perhaps feels more like a cliche now. But I do think it's quite effective in that it's not... I don't think Kubrick's ever trying to... You know, he wouldn't stoop to a jump scare or anything like that. But he's trying to create this unsettling atmosphere.
Well, he does the jump scare later.
Well, he does, yes. He sort of. But he's not quite crass about it. Or at least he tries to feel above it. There's a specific scene that King absolutely hated. And he explained why. But we'll talk about that when we come to it. This did work to unsettle me. There is something uncanny valley, and maybe it's just Kubrick's direction, but it works well here because this is what it's supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be vaguely unsettling and disturbing.
Well, also our friend and occasional co-host Shim has been talking recently about the isolation of horror. It's much harder to have a horror effect if you have two or three people in a group. Because they can say, did you see that? Yeah, I saw it too. I'm not just going mad. You know, I can go to sleep while you keep watch, and then we swap up and so on. It's harder to get the horror effect in a group. But here I think there is a group.
Particularly psychological horror.
But each of them perceives the others as unreliable. You know, Danny is a kid. Wendy is flaky. Jack is clearly not. For anybody else to rely on, and largely not for himself. So it does still, for each of them is feeling isolated, even though they can see each other basically whenever they want to.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, they aren't a kind of a, you know, we play a lot of role-playing games, they're not a party in that sense, you know, they're just a group of people all individually isolated. We don't see a lot of moments of tenderness between Danny and his mum, but there's an obviously much closer relationship there than with Danny and his dad, where we get one scene where he shows some vaguely fatherly tendencies, which we'll see later on. Danny, Jack is struggling to write his book, and seems to be, he's set up in this great chamber. And again, in the book, he's like a slow deterioration, but here he's immediately like, you know, Wendy comes to visit him and he's just like, fuck off. You know, he's just really unpleasant to her right away. Danny gets lured or otherwise ends up at room 237, and encounters ghosts. And he's actually, do we actually see him attacked by a ghost in room 237?
No.
I don't think we do. But he returns, Wendy finds bruises on him and blames Jack, because of the
and
history.
That was an interesting thing, because clearly Jack feels betrayed by the assumption that she would think this. But even though in the film, in the cut I saw, we don't know that he has form for doing exactly this, he has been acting for the entire film like someone who would do exactly this, who would lash out in a moment of temper.
So it's not jarring to you when he does that?
Yeah.
When he's accused of it?
This is the thing. If he had a little bit of self-awareness, he would be able to say, yes, all right, I know I do have form for this, and I can understand why you feel that way, but I genuinely didn't, and there is some danger here that we need to work together against.
But because he's... I mean, it works better for the film, because, you know, instead he gets bitterer and more, and coming back to your isolation, he becomes more isolated from the two of them, and begins spending more time on his own. He himself goes to room 237 to investigate.
And this is where I remember that, yes, just because the third digit of the film's year is 8, that does not mean it's an 80s film. It's very much a 70s film. It's got that same thing of, oh yeah, we can show tits now, and we don't, and, and it doesn't have to be porn.
Well, again, it's a very kind of, so there is a lady in the room. She gets out of the bath, and it's very.
And Jack's immediate reaction is, yeah, let's snog her a bit.
Yes, which he ends up regretting because she turns into a terrifying elderly lady, laughing.
And rotting.
And rotting. Now, I'm not
that's
clear.
The moment I regard as the jump scare, by the way.
Yeah, it isn't, that's what I thought you meant. It isn't quite kind of in your face. It, because it's done sort of slowly, he sort of steps back and then realizes what he's doing. It isn't sort of, haha, gotcha. Because again, I suspect Kubrick wouldn't dare to, wouldn't deign to jump to that sort of jump scare. Again, it's quite unsettling. And it, I guess for the viewer, it sort of confirms there probably is something external.
Well, again, that could be Jack's hallucination.
Yes, it could, yes. Because it seems tailored to him in a way specifically. What Danny saw, we don't know. Now, I don't know whether the assumption here is that the two girls are the children that were murdered and the woman...
It's a strong implication, I think.
But then I'm not sure who this ghost in 237... Is this the wife? Because she seems too old, but I don't know whether...
She is the wife who perhaps rotted before the thaw came and everybody was found.
Yeah, I guess it's... I guess you could also, as you say, you could argue, Jack, if it's all in Jack's mind, then it doesn't really matter to some extent, because he sees what he wants to see, and then he is sort of, you could argue, his own... mental health issues cause him to hallucinate in a different way to betray himself. Regardless, he heads down to the bar, the bar empty of alcohol, but he finds it full of people. And he has the barman who, I could not see as anyone but Tyrell from Blade Runner, but it isn't Tyrell from Blade Runner, but it's the same actor. And he has a conversation, and Jack is sort of unperturbed by this particularly. And I do find that when people, I understand it in the context of film, but when people react in a way that isn't consistent with how I would react, you know, he just takes it all in his stride, I find it disconnecting. But I guess we're not supposed to be empathising with Jack at this point. If we ever were, we're supposed to be moving back from him a bit.
Well, I think in terms of his mental state at this point, there is a shelf full of booze over there and... He has just met something that has essentially exceeded his ability to cope.
Yes.
And he is reaching for the thing that helps. And if the barman's a bit creepy, well, the barman is still giving him booze.
Yes, exactly. Here he encounters Grady, the previous caretaker, who is...
Ish.
Well...
There's a strangeness in there. I don't know if this is in the book. We've been told the previous caretaker was Charles Grady, who killed his wife and kids.
But this
guy is Delbert Grady.
He also doesn't seem, I mean, here he's a very prim and proper kind of maitre d', butler, waiter,
though,
character.
Though he does come on to, you need to correct your wife and child.
I forget how it goes in the novel, but it is explicitly the Grady that did the thing. And in the film it is as well.
Yeah, I have seen some comments suggesting that, you know, that the two different names are terribly significant in some way, but I don't think there's anything in the film actually to support that.
It may be as simple as he was Charles Delbert Grady, but why would you introduce that confusion?
Yeah.
I don't know. But anyway, he has a chat with Jack... And suggests, you know, basically, that he should kill his wife and child, because they need correcting. And Jack does show, again, this is one of the tests, but he doesn't really show any resistance to the idea, very slightly, as I recall, but not really. And again, we're not expecting him to, because the whole way through this film, he's been quite an unpleasant character, and it doesn't seem much of a step.
Make as a side note, this is the same model of alcoholism that Alcoholics Anonymous push, which is once you've taken the one drink, you are essentially lost to anything, so you absolutely must avoid taking that one drink.
Yeah, that's a problem in the sense that if you fail, then you might as well just fail full on. Whereas it's much better to have, again, with it's much better to think of yourself as someone who doesn't drink, who has an occasional slip up, rather than...
I have erred and now I will fix this, rather than I have erred, there is no hope for me.
Exactly. So if I'm going to hell anyway, let's go the whole hog. Might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. But yes, he returned to
about the B plot, because sometime earlier, basically when Jack got very angry at the suggestion that they should leave, Danny used his telepathy to call Halloran.
That's right. He was in a hotel in Miami or somewhere, I think.
The bedroom of naked black chicks with huge froze.
Yes.
This is the decoration rather than extras, I should say.
Yes. it's quite an effective scene. There is something a bit unsettling about it. Halloran tries to contact the Overlook. Jack smashes the radio up because all good lunatics. Well, again, it's about the isolationism of horror. If you've got someone you can call on the phone or the radio, it immediately takes away a lot of the horror.
Yeah.
So Jack smashes the radio up.
The local police are aware that, because they have the other end of the radio, in effect, they're aware that nobody's answering. But I get the impression that this is a fairly huge storm. They have a whole lot of other stuff to do. Going and checking on some people whom they have no reason to suppose are in distress would be a low priority. Nobody actually says this, but that's my read on this, and I think it makes sense.
Yeah, and the other impression is, well, you know, it's not that weird that the radio goes down in this kind of weather, so it's not that suspicious. But Halloran is suspicious, so he starts making his way to the Overlook.
Yeah, we get occasional shots of him, you know, on the plane, getting as far as he can in the car, and borrowing another snow vehicle, and so on. And we'll come back to where that ends up.
Things are going south pretty rapidly over at the Overlook, though, because so Jack's sort of gone back and said, oh, nothing happened in the hotel, don't worry. And he has sort of a last few tender moments with Danny, almost, in that he cuddles. Again, it's quite an effective scene in that Jack's trying to be affectionate with Danny. Danny is clearly uncomfortable with this because it's not something that happens very often. And it's just, it's a nicely played scene. But then we sort of get into we're heading towards the third act now, because we've had the middle with the slow deterioration. But what triggers the climax is that Wendy comes down to see what Jack's been working on. And she finds this whole stack of papers. And every single one of them is typed out in various different ways. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And he's
now,
doing this.
I think that may actually be from the life. I don't know if this is the same in the book. But I have been told by writers old in wickedness that if you are feeling blocked, one good way to deal with it is to, you've got your allocated time to write, you sit down at the keyboard and you type stuff. And if all you can type is, I hate this, I hate this, then that's fine. You just keep doing it, and eventually your brain will give up and give you something more interesting to type.
Yes, I've heard a similar strategy. So maybe it started out like that, but it's clearly either not working very well. But it's a well-played scene. Now, this is the scene that King absolutely hated, because sort of halfway through the scene, we then see from Jack's perspective, and he sort of slowly approaches her. And King was of the opinion that any director who knew what they were doing with horror would have Jack sort of appear behind her while she's making this decision. You get the bang of the discovery, oh shit, something is seriously wrong with Jack, and then he's there, instead of this kind of slow kind of so there's no kind of surprise. It's not quite a jump scare, but you know, he's just there, and King just hates it. It was like, why would you not take that brilliant opportunity? I feel like Kubrick knew exactly what he was doing and didn't want this to be a jump scare.
I didn't feel generally creeped out by this at all. by the film as a whole. But there were some good moments, and I think that was one of them.
Yes, I thought so. So I think it's a telling that King wants it to be a different sort of film from a different director, and I just don't think Kubrick's ever going to do that sort of thing. But then it goes south to the point where he is clearly unhinged and clearly to the point of harming Wendy and Danny, and clearly wants to do it, and then he starts talking about, I'm just going to bash your brains out. Whereupon Wendy beats him unconscious with a baseball bat, which I feel like Wendy is considered to be a bit of a stereotypical scream queen, but she's pretty resourceful here. She beats him unconscious and locks him in a room, and she's not going to let him out.
Specifically, this is the kitchen pantry, which has a big heavy door and lock, presumably to keep the temperature stable or something of that sort. It's not refrigerated, yes, but it's a big food storeroom.
So Jack's got plenty to eat, if nothing else.
And this is the point where the ambiguity ends.
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah, because, and I think it's a shame because... Yeah, sorry.
Because it is Grady who lets him out. It's not a locked door. It's just a door that only has a latch on the outside.
And there is no, we are clearly shown that Wendy locks it correctly. It's not that she hasn't done it by mistake. The only way he gets out of that room is by the ghost of Grady, unless he's telekinetic or something. But even that, Grady lets him out, and it's explicit. There is no other way that he gets out of that room. So the ambiguity ends. We know there is. And then it becomes less ambiguous because he starts chasing them through the hotel, and Wendy starts experiencing the same visions that Danny has had. Danny has deteriorated to the point where he's just this kind of... he's the extra... He's his little fictional character whose name I've forgotten. But basically, he's become him. We get the Creed... Did the Red Rum seem creeped out at all? I remember finding it very creepy when I was a kid, because I knew, or when I watched it when I was younger. It did scare my son. So that was something. Though he'd already figured out that Red Rum and murder, but.
One of the odd things for me is that I do actually recall dimly the process of learning to read and write. And I did not, and I never saw anybody who did write letters backwards in error. Maybe that is a thing that people do, but I have never personally seen it. So when I see it, I immediately think, well, maybe this is a mirror thing. But the mixture of some backwards and some not just throws me a bit.
I think in the book it does happen, and Kubrick was utterly unimpressed because he thought, well, everyone would know that was Murder Straight. So he tried to make it a bit harder to read. Possibly. I might be misremembering, but I think there was some ding-dong between King and Kubrick about that. So Jack goes on the rampage around about the time that Halloran has driven through the storm. Oh, we have also seen that Wendy was going to leave Jack locked there while she took the snow cat. I'm going to call it snow cat from the film, except that Jack has taken the spark plugs out of the snow cat. I imagine they're spark plugs. Something stops it working.
Looks to me like a distributor cat, but in any case, he has sabotaged it in a way she cannot quickly repair.
She would need the things that he has, and he's either smashed them or hidden them. But Halloran turns up. Now, in the book...
Well, hang on. We've got the whole here's Johnny before that.
Oh, that, yes, that's
so,
right.
So Wendy and Danny are holed up in the suite, and Jack comes after them with the axe. She gets Danny through the bathroom window. And he can slide down the snow to the outside.
But she can't fit.
She can't get through it. So she fights him off with a knife.
Now this is an iconic scene, the bashing the door open. Again, I find it quite, because it's,
I think, on the UK poster, which is the one that's on Wikipedia.
It's also on the cover of my version of The Shining. It's Jack poking its way through the first. And that was quite an early edition of The Shining, but they use it as... I think what is effective is the physicality of the scene. You really see, he has to swing the axe back and smack it through the door and then work it free and pull it back. There's something about this is a man actually physically trying to knock through a door with an axe, and this is how that would look. There's something about the whole physicality of it, I think, makes it quite an effective scene for me. Did that work for you?
Not really.
Okay.
Essentially, I just didn't really care about Jack's state of anything at this point.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, so, I mean, weren't you worried for Wendy? Did you feel any...
Well, yeah, but the focus is all on Jack.
Yeah, okay, yes.
The impression I get is that the director's vision doesn't really care about Wendy. It wants to show this cool guy smashing down the door.
I think this might be the bit where Wendy is, or Shelley Duvall is accused of overacting. I think she does pretty well. You know, she looks like I would feel, if someone was trying to kill me with an axe. But she still fights him off pretty effectively. You know, she's not some weak, she's not paralyzed by fear. She's just terrified and doing what she can.
Well, if we accept my model of the abusive relationship, then she has a lot to overcome to get to that point.
Right.
And I think if you regard her acting as essentially portraying that, it makes a certain amount of sense.
It worked for me. I do find it... I mean, I don't know that it's scary, but I found it did build tension. She does fight him off and escapes. Halloran turns up and sees there's something unusual going on, whereupon Jack hits him in the chest with an axe, and that's the end of Halloran.
Yeah, and I might have appreciated this more if it had not been a blatant rip-off of Bernard Herrmann's that theme from Psycho in the background.
But, yes.
But, you know, we've had Halloran coming all the way back, this great troublesome journey, just to be killed. Mm. So he is both the magical Negro and the black guy is first to die.
Yes, fair. It's also a trick that has not only been pulled before, it's pulled again in Misery, very similar thing, though it's not a black guy that dies then, it's a cop. But this, interestingly, doesn't happen in the book. Halloran survives the attack, and they all escape together. Mm. It does happen here, and basically this whole plot reason for Halloran coming is that he supplies them with a new snow cap so they can escape. But that's, having done his job, the black guy gets it, basically.
Yeah, just thinking about it from a simple preparedness point of view, I suspect that if one had just the one radio, expecting the phone lines to go out, one would probably want some kind of distress flare. I don't know how far this is from anywhere, whether that would be a possible thing, but one would want some sort of backup to the thing that is expected to be the only thing that works.
I think they're 20 or 30 miles, but whether that's as the crow flies or just the length of the road, I
don't know. One would want some kind of "we are in real trouble" medical emergency signal, I feel, but anyway.
I don't know if he's that prepared. I guess he wasn't expecting to.
Oh, and I'm thinking the hotel would make this available to its caretaker.
Yes, you would think so. Yes, there'd be, anyway. That's fair. It also, I suppose, gives Jack a win, because otherwise he fails utterly at everything he ever does. So it gives him something, it increases his menace in that, yes, he can kill people, and this is the one person that he manages to finish off in the film.
So we've got Wendy running through the hotel looking for Jack, for Danny. We've got Jack running around looking for Danny. We've got Danny running into the maze, which was established earlier. I did feel that it was kind of obviously a maze just from looking at the hedges without you having to show me the great big sign with the map of the maze, but...
It's fair enough. It establishes it. And again, it's visually striking, them sort of running through the snow-filled maze. Danny finally shows some kind of proactivity and intelligence, which I feel like he has not shown in the entire film currently. Mm. But he realizes that Jack, his dad, is following the tracks and he's going to find him. So he backtracks some way and then hides in the hedge, within the tissue of the hedge, the connective tissue, within the hedge. And Jack runs past, and being crazed and probably concussed, to be fair, fails to find his way out of the maze. Danny does.
Probably freezes to death.
Yes, yes. we think. So Danny...
Danny gets out. Wendy finds him. They get into Halloran's snow track. It is implied that they have survived.
So in the book... it's a very different ending. Jack has basically become possessed by the hotel spirit. And he confronts Danny, but there is one last moment where he sort of comes to himself and says, Danny, get away, before he's taken over again. He is killed.
But I thought there were some earlier moments where Kubrick was trying to do that, but it was never quite clear.
I mean, it's difficult because Jack has always been this character, really. He is killed in the film and then, in the book, and reanimated by the hotel. Because he's not been relieving the pressure on the boiler like he's supposed to, the hotel then explodes. I have read The Shining. It is quite scary. It's a very King novel. It's very readable. But like a lot of King stories, the ending sometimes leaves a bit to be desired. So comparing it to the film, or comparing the film to the book, I think the film is quite a bit superior to the book, personally. Does that mean I think the film is a masterpiece? I think it's visually spectacular.
It has certainly been very widely imitated, which is one of our legs of this.
It's always tricky to then look at it in isolation from all these years later.
My reaction as the end credits were rolling was this was so busy being pretentious it forgot to be scary.
I think that's fair. I think this was King's opinion in a way as well. He didn't use any of the horror tricks that he could have done. I find it unsettling. But I find most of Kubrick's work vaguely unsettling. I did find it unsettling, not particularly scary. My son wasn't particularly scared by it. And some unsettling, disturbing films stay with you and the imagery stays with you. I can't say that's particularly happened with The Shining on this watch.
Yeah, I could picture, if I'd approached it at the right age and in the right mood, yes, it might well have lodged in that way. I didn't love it. I honestly was spending more time trying to look at the relationship angle.
Yes.
And because I didn't have that early scene of the alcoholism and so on, I was writing down, well, why are they even married? They don't seem to like each other.
I think you're right. It is.
Even when he's as good as he's getting, they don't seem to like each other. I start thinking, did he get her pregnant and have to marry her? That kind of thing.
But that's more than Kubrick seems interested in exploring.
Well, yeah, I will admit that what I really like in film, I like other things as well, but what I insist on is character.
Yeah. And it's, as you say, there isn't a character arc. I don't always need character arcs. I love the Indiana Jones.
I don't
Jones
need
film.
An arc, but it helps.
We
could have the guy who is down who comes through, or we could have the guy who is clearly a great guy but fails. Either of those is a progression, but here it doesn't feel like much of a progression.
The guy is an asshole that fails.
Nobody would sensibly have expected him to succeed.
We did forget the little coda that after freezing to death in the maze, Jack then appears in the old photos of the hotel. So there is something strange going on. Again, I'm not sure quite what that, other than, ooh, this is a creepy thing. I'm not sure that it's particularly clever or what it's supposed to mean.
Well, the way I think I would interpret that, if I were trying to run it in a game or something of that sort, is there is the animating spirit which is lodged in the hotel as a whole. And when it is trying to interact with humans, it puts on the guise of people who have been here and died before. Which is why we get the creepy girls to Danny, why we get the wife and then Grady to Jack. But none of that is actually an individual. That is all the hotel as a whole. And then the hotel as a whole has added Jack to its repertoire. And the next guy in 20 years' time may well meet Jack.
I mean, I think as a ghost story, I've read some really weird interpretations of this, like that ball was on the 4th of July, and therefore this is an analogy of either American imperialism or the massacre of Native Americans, because there's Native American motifs throughout the hotel. I think, I don't know.
There's a suggestion that it was the cliche of built on an Indian burial ground, which I believe even that is actually Kubrick. That is not King being cliched.
Oh, really? I don't know about any of that, really. I mean, maybe.
I read somebody suggesting it was a metaphor for the Holocaust as well, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you like. I don't think there's enough in there to be explicit about that. You can read, as a ghost story on its own terms, I do think it works in that it's sort of internally consistent and you can, you know, it's not, it follows its own logic. I'm a little disappointed. I think you probably were as well, that it actually becomes explicit that it is a ghost story. I think I would have liked it to still be a bit more ambiguous if there was some way you could have got out of that room otherwise. But I think as a ghost story with some psychic elements, it works well. I don't know if I'm particularly excited by that story, because as you say, I'm not very interested in the characters, and that's the fundamental problem.
Yeah, there were bits that worked, but overall I did not enjoy this, I'm afraid.
Fair enough. I was probably a bit more positive in that. I remember it being very slow, and it wasn't as slow as I remembered. My son enjoyed it. But didn't rave about it, but enjoyed it. I found it enjoyable time, if that's the right term. But I think it was less cold than I remembered with Kubrick, but I still get that sense of he's much more interested in visuals than humans. And I know that's a cliche with Kubrick, but I think it's a cliche for a reason, because it feels that's the impression I get from this film and from Full Metal Jacket, and in most of his films, in fact, other than Dr. Strangelove, and I guess that's because it's very hard to make Peter Sellers not be anything other than Peter Sellers.
But also here we do have the specific example of, here is a bit of shiny new tech that I could use, I will use it.
Yes, yeah, the Steadicam, which again, I think, do we get a lot of that in Full Metal Jacket? I think we probably do.
Well, it's pretty new when this comes out.
Yeah, so it's the new thing. I liked it. I think it's very famous for a reason, and the visuals are very famous. I am well aware many people would think this is an absolute masterpiece and one of the greatest horror films ever. I don't agree. But I don't think it's a bad film. I think it's quite good, but it's let down by the characters not being warm. I think King hates it for the wrong reasons, perhaps. I think the fact that Jack's so unsympathetic, whereas King wrote this as a semi-autobiographical novel, probably has some reason why he didn't like the film very much.
I could picture a story in which the good guy with flaws is turned to the bad, but that is not the story that this film tells. It may be more the story that the book tells.
Well, King also got a chance to remake this himself as a TV film. You may not be surprised to hear it is widely regarded as utterly crap. So I haven't seen it myself. There is a sequel with a grown-up Danny called Doctor Sleep, which I've neither read nor seen. I gather it is quite good, but I don't read a lot of King nowadays. I don't think I'll.
Fair enough.
I feel like I've read enough of him that I've got everything I'm going to get out of him, which is fine. Well, there we are, The Shining. Nice try, Stanley, but not quite for us. Definitely not for you, Roger, but for me, I didn't hate it. I would watch it again, potentially, but I wouldn't be in a rush to.
I can't see myself wanting to watch it again, but yeah. As I say, there are bits that worked. Dick Halloran was potentially going to be off playing played by Slim Pickens.
Really? Interesting.
But Slim Pickens remembered working with Dr. Strangelove and said, only if you can do me in less than 100 takes. And Kubrick said no.
So Slim Pickens said no.
Yeah.
I would find it...
No, Kubrick said no, I cannot promise you less than 100 takes.
Yeah, so Slim Pickens said, right, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, yes, I for me, moderate enjoyment. Not a masterpiece for me. I would certainly not argue with people who thought it was for reasons, for other reasons. I think it's not quite, personally.
I possibly would, but
Yeah.
Right, well, there we are. We will be back in another few weeks with another horror film, but quite a different one. We shall see you then.